This is a time of year when people take stock. And we want to start today with a conversation with a couple who've had a lot to reflect on. Journalist David Rode and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill. You may know at least part of their story. Christmas 2008 was supposed to be their first as newlyweds. But instead, David, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter, was kidnapped by Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan and was being moved into the dangerous no-man's land on the border with Pakistan. "I think to myself that we are in a giant insane asylum," he wrote. Kristen was in New York setting up photo shoots for Cosmopolitan for articles with titles like "My Bra Saved My Life," ducking out to meet FBI agents in a parked car, just like a scene in The Sopranos, she thinks. David was kidnapped by the same Taliban commander he'd set out to interview, the last interview he felt he needed to finish a book he was writing about a place called Little America, a town built in Afghanistan by Americans during the Cold War, a place where Afghans remembered Americans fondly. He wanted to know what had gone wrong. He didn't get that book, but he got another one. It's called A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. In it, David and Kristen give a fascinating moment-by-moment account of 7 months of anguish and, ultimately, faith. They both join us in the studio. And, David, start with you. The first sentence in the book is, "This is not a story of triumph." But you did escape with your translator, Tahir. Your driver, Assad, eventually escaped. So why isn't this a story of triumph?
I guess because I just regret going to this interview and my new wife of 2 months had to go through this experience. 7 of the first 9 months we spent together as a married couple were incredibly difficult for her, and you know, I'll always regret that.
And Kristen, in the early moments when you find out that David had been kidnapped, mm-hmm. and it's this incongruous world, you're in, yes. in a high-rise in Manhattan, you know.
Exactly.
But you also then get a note that he left behind. A friend, yes. sends it on a BlackBerry from Kabul, and in which he, you know, he sort of scribbles to you, I'm so sorry I had to do this. You know, in the event,
yes.
he was kidnapped, and he,
yes.
was. And this note doesn't comfort you. You feel what?
I was angry that he hadn't consulted me on the interview. I quickly realized the kidnappers are responsible for the kidnapping, not David.
You felt a little of what David just expressed, that, you know, he'd sort of thrown you under the bus and your marriage under the bus to go on this interview.
Yes, I mean, I felt that. I felt confusion, fear, you name it, I felt it all.
How about ice in your veins, fear, David? What's that like? You had been kidnapped before in Bosnia by Christians after reporting on the massacre of Muslims there. And when you realize that it's happening again, what I say ice in veins, that's how it felt reading it.
Yeah, I think, one of the lines from the book is that sort of shame washing over me. An interview that seemed, you know, vitally important a few hours earlier now seems sort of reckless. I thought the interview would be fine. I met the night before the interview with a European journalist who had met this Taliban commander twice, and she said, "It will be more dangerous to you because you're American, but I don't think he'll kidnap you."
And yet, it is happening. How long did you think, "I'm going to be killed"?
The first, you know, 5 minutes were very confusing because we were driving to the meeting point we've been told to meet the men, the fighters of this commander. And, as we were approaching this meeting point, we were told to continue down the road to go to another meeting point. He changed the location, and then a car blocked the road, and gunmen came out and ordered, you know, the driver and Afghan journalists out of our car into the backseat with me. And it all happened in maybe 15, 30 seconds. And Tahir did say they're going to kill us. We said, "We're here to interview this commander," and they said, "We don't know who you're talking about." And, they just drove us off in the desert, and, those first few minutes, it was very unclear what was going to happen. And, you kind of go in the survival mode, and you just continue functioning, mm-hmm. and you're somehow hopeful that you'll survive.
And meantime, you both think, and who wouldn't think, of the Pearls? You know, Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was executed after he was kidnapped in Pakistan, Marianne Pearl. And you, Kristen, call Marianne.
You know, she told me I would probably be getting advice from everyone and really to follow my gut in every decision I made. And I think that was the best advice.
What's astonishing about reading your side of the story, Kristen, is, I don't know, we just assume when this happens, and it happens far too often, but all these experts sweep in and mm-hmm. take over. And you really were in charge. I mean, you realized that you knew more about Afghanistan, for instance, than some of the FBI workers.
Than some of the local field agents.
Yeah.
We met with a local office in New England, actually, and I had gone through David's emails. I had the password to his account and sort of looked up everybody he knew in the region, people who he had interviewed, other journalists, and tried to contact everyone just to see what I should be doing. I also had tremendous support from the New York Times. So our unit was a representative from the New York Times, myself, David's brother. The FBI quickly swooped in and trained me how to take phone calls from the captors and whatnot. Our family reached out to the State Department. We also hired a private security team. You know, the FBI sort of advises you to try to push the case towards negotiations, but the FBI themselves cannot negotiate for the family. That's really the family's responsibility. And there's no sort of coordination between governments. Other governments pay for release of hostages. There was a case with the Korean government, I think maybe a few months before David's case, where they had paid. There was rumors that the French and Italians had paid. And I don't think the people holding David really distinguished between governments. So that was a real problem. We're actually working with CPJ, Committee to Protect Journalists, to try to, you know, come up with some guidelines for families of kidnapped victims.
But meantime, here you are, you're sort of directing this whole thing while directing photo shoots
like Cosmo.
For Cosmopolitan. Couldn't be a stranger disconnect because you want to keep it very secret. And we remember this because, you know, colleagues who know you were hearing this through the grapevine, David, and yet the word was keep it secret.
Yes.
Which became very hard.
It was difficult. I mean, I tried to maintain my job for some sense of normalcy, but in the middle of the day, I was taking calls from security agents, ducking out to meet with the FBI, as you mentioned. I stand by the decision to keep it private and out of the media. I believe that's one of the reasons David is still here today. We weren't dealing with a legitimate government. We were dealing with extremists. And based on some of the early phone communications, they actually told us to keep it quiet. As the case progressed, we received videos in which they tried to negotiate directly with, you know, President Obama. And we did not want David's case to be used as a public platform for the Taliban to try to negotiate with our government. That would have been disastrous.
That's Kristen Mulvihill. She and her husband David Rode write about David's kidnapping in Afghanistan in 2008 in their book A Rope and a Prayer. And so, David, as our story continues, here you are in month 3, 4. You're moved from house to house. You didn't know where you were. You sob, you cry to show your captors that you're humble and not a spy. And you're finding out that, in fact, your kidnappers interpret that in the exact opposite way.
Yeah, what was extraordinary was being so close to the Taliban, and the local largest and local ethnic group is the Pashtuns, and there's a tribal code called Pashtun Wali, and the Taliban have kind of taken that to an extreme. So instead of showing that I miss my wife, the fact that I cried, you know, and asked them to release us was shown that I had no faith in God. Mm-hmm. You know, you should never show fear or weakness, and the only reason you would show fear or weakness is if you were somehow guilty of something. And B, you could be crying because you fear death, and you should welcome death, because for the Taliban, the only relationship that matters for you is your relationship with God, and the only world that matters to you is the next world. And there was this constant drumbeat from them that all Westerners were sort of hedonists that were focused on the pleasures of this world. Mm. You know, I thought I was helping myself, but I was doing the wrong thing.
Well, and you ultimately learned you were set up, that the guy you thought you were going to interview was, in fact, the guy who had kidnapped you. And the Haqqani family enters the picture. This is the family that rules this region on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border and is said to have ties to al-Qaeda. What did you learn, though, on a real human level about the Taliban and these people because you were up so close?
The Taliban, who are operating in the tribal areas of Pakistan, the Haqqani network, are extremely dangerous because it's essentially a fulcrum where young Afghan and Pakistani Taliban are being exposed to and learning from foreign militants and al-Qaeda members. They talked to me about a legend of an army emerging from Afghanistan and liberating the holy cities of Saudi Arabia. I lived with a suicide bomber for several weeks. He said that any Muslim that was currently living in, you know, Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, or Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, because they lived under these, they call them apostate pro-Western regimes, every person living in those cities was no longer a Muslim. And suicide bombs would be set off in mosques, and dozens of Muslims would be killed as they worshipped God, and they would cheer this. I said, you know, do you really want to die? Aren't you going to miss your family? And he said no. The only relationship that mattered to him was his relationship to God. And it was a fascinating kind of front row seat on how a young suicide bomber is brainwashed. And a key element of that is separating these connections to family.
On the other hand, there were little acts of grace from some of your guards.
They got bored as the months went by. Also, one thing we would do to kind of get by at night was sing songs. One of their favorite Taliban songs was called "You Have Atomic Bombs, But We Have Suicide Bombers." Mm-hmm. And they even had me sing songs in English. They wanted to hear American songs. So, you know, I was trying to convince them I wasn't a millionaire, so I actually sang Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run to them and explain the lyrics of, like, the struggles of an average American. But their favorite song was a song that actually popped into my head when Kristen sent me a letter, and that was the Beatles song, She Loves You. And I would sing in English, and they would sing with me, you know, She Loves You, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they just, you know, that's what we would do at night after having dinner.
Well, you also, you went on a picnic with a Taliban commander. Your guards got into a snowball fight with the translator Tahir and the driver Assad. And Kristen, I just, as this goes on,
yes,
months now, months, I guess just to talk for a second about faith. Mm-hmm. Because when you do talk to David and see videos and write letters back and forth, you're remarkably calm. Where'd you find that?
I had prayed all along. That was a way to surrender without giving up. And when I couldn't find the words within myself or that positivity, I kind of reverted to prayers from childhood, one of which is mentioned in the book, the Prayer of St. Francis, which was one of the hymns played at our wedding. So I would say that every night I desperately wanted some sort of ritual that would keep me connected to my husband and also give me peace of mind.
The St. Francis prayer, that's the hymn, that's the Lord make me an instrument of your
peace.
Yes,
exactly.
Just beautiful.
Exactly.
And how about you, David? Because interestingly, you know, you've embarked on this whole 10-year writing odyssey because of the question, you know, about religion post 9/11. You were there at the base of the towers when one of them collapsed. Did I read that correctly? You were reporting there. And Kristen, you were blocks away. I mean, you also lived in New York. So your whole, it seems like all of your writing was about, what's the role of organized religion? And you say you still are skeptical about organized religion, but it sounded like prayer was part of your salvation.
I had covered the war in Bosnia. I'd seen religious extremism do terrible things. I'd seen religious violence, you know, in India. I've seen members of every faith commit atrocities, and then I found myself in captivity. And I, you know, over time turned to prayer myself. And, you know, I'm still skeptical. I don't know if you know, when I prayed, you know, there was some great God that heard me and then reached down and comforted me, or if it's just sort of a psychological trick. But it was religion in moderation helping for me. Yet at the same time, right in front of me, religion, you know, in an extreme form was really dangerous and destructive.
David Rode and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, their book, A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides, tells the story of what they both went through when David, a reporter for the New York Times, was kidnapped by insurgents in Afghanistan and held for 7 months, mostly in the tribal areas of Pakistan, until he and his translator, Tahir, escaped in the middle of the night while their guards were sleeping. They slipped from their room, grabbed a rope David had found and hidden earlier, and used that rope to lower themselves over a wall from the roof of the compound where they were being held. David, in the movies, when people escape, that's it. They hail a cab. But for you, escaping was almost as scary as being kidnapped.
There was no kind of sense of ecstasy when I was walking on my own for the first time in, you know, 7 months and 10 days. Instead, it was fear that maybe an even more dangerous group of militants would capture us, because where we were in this town, Miranshah in Pakistan, is full of Afghan and Pakistani militants, Uzbeks, Arab al-Qaeda members, and, you know, we were terrified about what would happen to us after we snuck out of the house. We decided to try to escape because we'd been moved to a house that was very close to the only Pakistani military base in Miranshah, and the really stark thing to see was that the Pakistani military made no effort to come off that base and confront the Taliban. At one point in our captivity, our guards were taking bomb-making classes. And these huge explosions would go off in town, and the Pakistanis would never come off the base.
Well, in fact, you are convinced that the ISI, you know, as everyone suspects, is working with the Taliban, sort of winning the war in Afghanistan, as you put it, through the Taliban while accepting American aid They're funding the very people that are killing American soldiers.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Steve Call, who's a well-known journalist who wrote the book Ghost Wars, he said it's this amazing situation where the United States is in essence at war with its ally.
Ultimately, you meet very kind Pakistani military men who you think are the future in this region. Gentlemen who, because of their religion, felt that they had to take you in and protect you. So it's sort of the opposite of what the religious fervor you were seeing.
Yeah, it was like religion at its best and its worst, and that this very young captain led us on this base when we walked there in the night. We nearly got shot by the guards at the outside of the base. They thought maybe we were suicide bombers. He lets us in, and he apologizes to me. He apologizes to me as a Pakistani. He apologizes to me as a Pashtun. And he gives me a book called The Glorious Islam. And it's a much more kind of moderate interpretation of Islam. The last thing we want is that this book and the story of this kidnapping is for people to think that the people who kidnapped me are representative of Afghans or Pakistanis or Muslims. I mean, they're not. They are not following Islam, according to all my Muslim friends. They've really sort of twisted the faith, and they were much more interested in money. And it was the hypocrisy I saw where they would drag this on, they would do this to my family, that made me really despise them. And it was really anger at them that led us to try to escape in the end.
Kristen, can you just tell us the moment you knew that he had escaped?
I was actually out and missed his escape call. My mother was staying with me in New York. So David phoned home after his escape from the base. And my mother quickly called me on my cell and said, run home. You know, David's escaped. He's with Tahir. My initial reaction, oh, my God, I hope my mother doesn't have a heart attack. And my, other thought was, oh, no, that's so dangerous, because I knew it was one thing to get off the compound or over a wall, but another to get out of Mirin Shah. I worried, as David did, that another group would pick him up. So after I got over that, the elation slowly crept in. But in the side of New York, we spent most of the evening trying to contact U.S. government officials, and they in turn contacted the Pakistanis and said, we know where David is. Please make sure he's safely exited from the region.
Do you both have a this has to be life-altering for you, David, because, two escapes. And you've said no more, foreign correspondence, no more war. That would seem to be a given. But, we also mentioned you survived 9/11. Do you feel somehow anointed is wrong, sounds wrong. Yeah, and you're saying that's wrong. But something, some sort of something that's changed you, that's made your life different. You're nodding yes.
There's a sense of resiliency. I also feel that, no situation is permanent. We've been through very difficult times. Obviously, the kidnapping was probably the worst thing either one of us has been through. But things can change very quickly in unexpected ways, and I sort of have the sense to appreciate every moment. But I think we're lucky. I really think we're lucky. Yeah.
David, your thoughts?
I'm sure it's luck. I feel like professionally, I have a duty to talk about, what's happening in Pakistan. The young man who tried to set off the truck bomb in Times Square recently was trained exactly where I was held hostage, and the Pakistani military has, not moved in, despite the fact the U.S. has recently, the Obama administration, increased aid to $2 billion a year to the Pakistani military. Personally, this was a really humbling experience, and we talk about Christmas, and in the end it was my family, my wife and my parents and my siblings that are the only ones that kind of in the end have your back, so to speak. Surviving this experience has given me a sense that I need to do more. To my family, and then whatever else I can do to help.
We both hope that in writing this book, we know our situation was extreme, but it has a happy ending. We hope it resonates sort of beyond us. Anybody dealing with, uncertainty, separation from a loved one, or if you're in the position to make life and death decisions for a partner when they can't do so for themselves, or just any situation that kind of catches you off guard, over which you have no control, I hope the book is somehow, hopeful for people going through those kinds of scenarios.
Just one thought. David, you're going to be taking out the trash for a long time.
It's very true. And I should be taking out the trash for a long time.
He does actually take out the trash. So that was a side perk.
Journalist David Rode, his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, the director of photography. Their book together is A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. Kristen, David, thank you so much, and happy holidays to you.
You too. Thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you.